Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies. Excited to see everybody here. We got a fabulous class today. It is a discussion of the interplay between community and individuality. And there's always a tension between the group and the individual. So let's give some examples. You know what? Let me ask you for some examples. Where might we see tension between the individual and the group? What type of setting might you have that type of tension?
Work.
Explain. Good. Explain. Right. So there's a team and there's an objective, and then you have an individual opinion that may not be on board. Where else? Good. Classroom. I was thinking about that, especially with kids. Oops. It's fine. What is? Explain. Explain.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of either it could be on either extreme, either be the student who is way accelerated and apart from the rest of the class, or the student who's way behind and is not comprehending what's going on.
And there's a tension for the teacher. Who do you teach to? Do you teach to a specific student? Do you teach to the general class? But who is the general class? It's not like there is a general class, right? There's no the average student. Who's the average student? That's math. That's not a person. That's not a real thing. So who do you teach to? Right? Do you teach to the highest, to the lowest, to the middle? But what's the middle? So you have the general class, but then you also have the individual. Where they're holding. Where else might we have? All these are great. Where else might we have? Hey, welcome back. Tension or the interplay, if you will, between the collective and the individual.
Shul.
Good.
Yeah. The question of you would think halacha is black and white, but sometimes with discussion, I don't imagine do we use instrument on Shabbat?
Right. So you have kind of like the general rules for everybody, but then you have specific situations, specific people, individuals. What else?
Sports.
On a team. Oh, there's no I in team. That's what they say, right? There's no I in team. Nonetheless, you have... There's a team, and then there are individuals. So the tension here is, really in most areas of life, how do you balance the collective versus the individual? And do you say that because it's in the collective good, therefore the individual has to conform, right? So a government says, look, for most citizens, this is the best way to do things. Therefore, everyone has to do this. But what if the individual says, well, that's good for everybody, but not good for me? So we tell this person, sorry, that's the way it's going to be. Right? You're the exception. Here's the rule. Deal with it. You have to bend toward the... Right? But today we live in a world in which individuality or individualism is a really big thing. We're really big into the individual and how the individual thinks or feels or acts, whatever. So there's always this tension, historically, nationally, governmentally, communally, when it comes to Judaism, you have this as well, in classrooms, in families, right? There are family expectations, let's say, family rules or whatever it is, but then each kid is an individual. So how do you balance? It's interesting, when it comes to education, so the verse, King Solomon writes, Chanoch lenar al pi darko. You educate a child according to his way. Gam ki yaskin lo yasur mimenu. And even when he gets old, he will not turn away, reject what you taught him. But the message here is, chanoch lenar al pi darko. You have to educate a child according to his way. There's no one size fits all with education. So even though you might think, we got to figure it out. This is the way we educate our children. These are our rules. These are the family rules, all this stuff. But then you have the individual. How do you balance between family and individual? I saw an article recently that talked about, I think, the 12 mistakes parents make. One of those articles. You know, everyone likes to list numbers and say, like, the 5 best ways, or the 12, you know, 12, what is it?
I told
Oh, right. Oh, so yeah, so good, right. So one of them is to think, one of the mistakes parents make is to think that the way things worked for child one will also work for child two and child three, or maybe it was written differently, that child two and three will be the same as child one. And that's a mistake the parents might make. Because each child is an individual. At the same time, there's a family unit. So what is the family and what's the individual? How do these things connect? So the common theme for tonight's class, we're going to look at many examples in Torah where you have this interplay, where you have this balance, if you will, or tension and balance, both, right, between the individual and the collective, the community and the individual. So let's begin. Torah portion of this week is Vayikra. And please open up the Chumash. We begin a new book this week, Book of Leviticus. And Leviticus is a translation, well, not a translation, the English word for Vayikra. Vayikra means called. God called to Moses and spoke to him at the beginning of the Torah, at the beginning of this book. And the portion, Leviticus, comes from the fact that, the English word comes from the fact that it is primarily instructions. This book contains primarily instructions that are given to the Kohanim and Levim, all from the tribe of Levi, hence Leviticus. It's all about the tribe of Levi, the priests and their assistants, the Levites. So it is also called Sefer HaKarbanot, the book of offerings, the book of sacrifices, because again, it talks about the Mishkan and its offerings extensively. So it begins in 6:18 and 6:19. And the first thing, the first mitzvah we have is about a voluntary offering for God. And it talks about which animals you bring a voluntary offering. On 6:21, we're going to go through this rapid fire. 6:21, we speak about burnt offering from cattle. 6:23, the burnt offering from sheep and goats. 6:25, burnt offering from birds. 6:27, the unbaked meal offering. Well, that one, half-baked. All right, next we have the baked meal offering on the same page, the shallow fried meal offering. This is like the menu, right? This is like the menu of the priest. Like, I'll take an unbaked meal offering and then a side of shallow fried meal offering. Okay, now, 6:29, this is big in Texas, Israel. The deep fried meal offering. Texas is deep fried? Why am I associating that? Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Okay, it is a thing.
Like they have the state fairs.
That's what it is. Yes, ice cream. Right. Yeah, fried matzah. Oof. Oh, it's fantastic. You fried matzah? You guys have? Yeah, neither have I.
Here, they even fried the French fries.
Right? Who does that?
Not the French.
What do they do in French? They have American fries. What do they have? How does that work?
No, but it's not. You potatoes. Here, like, there's an extra crust of fries sometimes.
Yeah. All right, laws, 6:29, laws pertaining to meal offerings, the Omer offering, 6:31, the peace offering. This was huge in the 60s, the peace offering from cattle.
Oh.
Folks, work with me here. 6:31, I have to get a laugh track for the podcast. I mean, seriously, it's going to go over that boo. It's going to go over that boo.
You need a light that says laugh.
Yeah, I know, or cue cards at least. Like. All right. When you hear me pause, that's usually a sign. Okay. The peace offering from sheep and goats, 6:33, forbidden fats and foods. The sin, okay. So that's just like, okay, you can't donate the fats and foods. Fine. And the blood. The sin offering is 6:33. High priest's sin offering. And then we have on 6:35, the communal sin offering. This is where we pick it up. Let's begin. Debbie, please begin. Page 6:35. Verse number 13, right after the caption or the header of the communal sin offering.
If the entire assembly of Jewish judges, the Sanhedrin, make a mistake and rule that an act which is in fact punishable by soul excision is permissible, and the matter was not detected by the eyes of the congregation, and they follow the Sanhedrin and violate any of God's commandments which are prohibited thereby, incurring guilt. And when the sin which they have committed becomes known, the congregation should bring a young bull as a sin offering.
Okay, so hold on. So here we have the communal sin offering. So what happens? The entire congregation sins. Oh, you know, do one more. Do one more, please. Okay. Sorry.
They should bring it before before the tent of meeting, the elders of the community should lean their hands on the bull's head before God, and one of them should slaughter the bull before God.
Okay, so this is the bull offering, and it's brought, and they do their thing. Okay, now, this is a communal sin offering, which means that the people sin. Now, why did they sin? We had the parentheses which help, Rashi, and which is Rashi's commentary a little bit. How did they sin? How did the entire community come to sin?
The judges.
The judges. So the Sanhedrin. It's their fault. They ruled on something that it's okay, and it turns out not okay. You know, there was recently a scandal in South Africa. Did you guys hear this?
Yeah.
Probably not. Very regional. Johannesburg. The largest kosher... This is huge. It's huge. Yeah. No, it is. It is. Yeah, no, it's totally legit. I feel like when I slow it down and I go like, it could go either way, and it usually goes, no, this is, right? See, no cue cards. There was a caterer who, for 40 years, these guys were the Jewish caterer, kosher caterer. Like, if you had a kosher event, big event, the whole deal. They had the Mahadran Commission. They had, like, Mahadran and Mahadran Commission, two levels of kosher. They did both standards, including the higher standard, which is the Chabad-friendly standard as well, but like the top-notch stuff, they were the guys. Two guys, they were everything. About 2 weeks ago, Mashgiach, or there was an inspection, something, they found in the kitchen for a Mahadran Commission event, this higher-level event, 20 treif chickens. Completely not kosher chickens. They launched an investigation, and it turns out, I don't know what the end of the investigation is, but this is not good, and the community, the assumption is that it's not something that they just happened to do for this event, but they've been feeding the community non-kosher. Now, you have to understand how big of a breach of trust this is. You know, first of all, forget the money. Don't forget the money. People pay good money for having kosher chicken. But imagine a couple starting their life together, they get married, they have a kosher wedding, or a bris, you have a kosher wedding, or a kosher, it's weird to have a kosher wedding at a bris, whatever, kosher catering at a bris, or bar mitzvah, or anything. And here you have the caterer standing there and the community is eating treif. I mean, how do you, that's... This is part of the investigation. Who was behind it, who knew, who didn't know, how long it's been going on, how did they do it, etc. Whatever. The thing is like this. The Kashrus Association, the Bet Din of Johannesburg. Here's my disclaimer. I'm not condemning the Bet Din of Johannesburg at all. What I'm saying is the following. The Bet Din puts their hechsher on this caterer and on the event. The caterer is a kosher caterer by virtue of the fact that the Bet Din certifies it. Now, the Bet Din obviously didn't know that this was going on until they found out that it was going on. But here you have people that thought they were eating kosher, that weren't eating kosher. They thought they were eating kosher because of the rabbis, the court, if you will, who said this is kosher food. And it turned out that they were wrong. It was not kosher food. So when we talk about how can it be that a whole community sins, I'm just bringing in reference to this, the communal sin offering. An entire community sins because the court, the judges, the Sanhedrin, they made a mistake. How does it happen? It happens. It happens. In this case, it seems like there was intentional deception on the part of the caterers or whatever, but mistakes happen. And so the Torah says, what happens if the entire community finds itself in a position where it violated a prohibition, committed a sin, due to the instruction, to the blessing, if you will, of the sages, of the judges, of the rabbis, of the Sanhedrin. So what do they bring as an atonement offering? What's the answer? What did we say in the text? A young bull as a sin offering. Good. Please open up your booklets to page...
How does a chicken become
non-kosher? How does it come not kosher? If it comes from a non-kosher supplier that didn't shecht it properly. You have to shecht the chicken properly, like an animal. I mean, similar to what you have to... Not only does it have to be a kosher animal or kosher bird, but you also have to slaughter properly and prepare it properly. So there's steps that are required.
And wouldn't you have to feed it properly, too? Like, wouldn't there be some sort of, like they're not eating kosher grain? Like, wouldn't you have to feed it properly?
You're allowed to fish with worms.
Oh, wow.
I'll pass.
Do you know what they put in gefilte fish? Not worms.
What's that?
If you go fishing and you use worms as bait, you're allowed to eat the fish. Even if the fish ate worms. It's a thing. It's not a thing.
The community members, though, that were eating, but they didn't know it wasn't kosher, is that
so? That's the big question now. It's not. I don't think this is what the Torah is talking about. Exactly. This was more. The Torah is not saying necessarily deception. This was a unique case, I think. I think the Bet Din put out that you don't have to. Oh, if anybody has any food from them, they have to throw it out. It's not kosher. It's assumed to not be kosher. If you use their food and cooked in it, you don't have to. The question is, you have to kosher all your pots and pans and plates and dishes. That's a big thing. I think they sent out a letter ruling that you don't have to, since it's an uncertainty. So you don't have to kosher everything that you own. Imagine what that would mean. And people that had kosher china, you can't kosher it. So if that was required, you have to break the whole, you have to just get rid of it. Anyway, it's serious stuff. Very serious stuff. Okay, let's jump into our Torah studies text. 2:11 in the booklets. And here is another series of verses from the book of Numbers. And what we're going to do is we're going to compare and contrast the verses that we just read in our Torah portion about a communal sin and the offering, which was a bull for a sin offering, with text number 2. Sarah, please take it away.
Anything that God has enjoined upon you through Moses, from the day that God gave the commandment and on through the ages, if due to the seers of the congregation the transgression was erroneously violated, the whole community shall present one young bull as a burnt offering of pleasing fragrance to God, and one young he-goat as a sin offering.
I'm going to ask soon a contradiction between the two sets of verses that we just read, Leviticus and Numbers. So pay attention to distinctions between what we're reading now and what we just read from our Torah portion about the communal sin offering. Please continue. The priest?
The priest shall atone on behalf of the whole Israelite community, and they shall be forgiven. For it was an error, and for their error they and their sin offering before God.
Continue, one more paragraph.
The whole Israelite community and the stranger residing among them shall be forgiven. For it happened to the entire people through error.
So here we have another case, situation where everyone is sinning, and it's because of the leaders of the congregation or something, and the people are sinning. And so what is the prescribed atonement package? What does it look like? What do you bring? Ah, so what's the difference? The he-goat. You never hear he-goat. Torah's got some he-goats. Right, so the he-goat in Leviticus. Hold on, there's two differences. In Leviticus, what do you bring? A young bull as what kind of offering? Sin offering. And in Numbers, you're bringing the young bull as a burnt offering, a fire offering, and the he-goat as a sin offering. Not only another animal, but the bull that was the sin offering before is now the fire offering or burnt offering, and the he-goat, which is new for a book of Numbers, the he-goat, right? This character makes an appearance. Now that's the sin offering. So obviously, the question is, other than the multiple author theory of Torah, which is, we don't have that, huh? Yeah. We've talked about that many times. Some people say, like, oh, the multiple authors, that's why there are these contradictions. Classic Torah thought says there's an explanation. Two different cases. Although they're both communal sins, there are nuances that you can perceive. If you look closely at the original Hebrew, you can perceive that these are actually two different cases of communal mistakes. Maimonides expresses it clearly 1,000 years ago in his writings, 900 years ago in his writings, text 3a. Yeah, what else?
The other difference is that if it's the priest that atones on behalf of the whole Israelite congregation.
Good, 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 good. The priest is involved now.
And
excellent.
Before, it was the whole community that has to bring the offerings. So
and here?
In Leviticus, it's the whole community. It says they have committed, become known, the congregation should bring a young bull as a sin offering. Here, the priest atones for everybody.
Right.
And brings...
Where do you see that? In the second one?
Yeah.
Or the first one?
In the second one, it says the priest.
Well, it says, in the second paragraph, it says the whole community shall bring that one young bull.
Where?
The second paragraph on page 211.
Yes, you're right. Correct. Yeah, it also says the community shall bring. Yeah.
Well, right here. Okay,
yes.
But
it still adds the priest.
It still adds the priest.
Good, yeah. Good, good. So here's how it's explained. Two different cases. In the first case, now it only works in the Hebrew. Look back at text 1. Text 1 was what Debbie read in the Chumash itself. But just let's stick with the books that we have. Text 1 says, I'm going to read it in the Hebrew. Ve'im kol hadas Yisrael, and if the entire congregation of Israel, yishku, will make a mistake, ve'nelam davar, and something is concealed, me'enei ha'kohol, from the eyes of the congregation, va'asu achas mikol mitzvos Hashem, and they did one of the prohibitions, asher lo yisaseinu va'ashemu, one of the things that they shouldn't do, they did. So it's one of the things. Look at text 2 from Numbers, v'chi sishku v'lo yisasu es kol ha-mitzvos ha'ela. If you make a mistake and you don't do all of the mitzvos. So text 1 is talking about if you make a mistake with how many mitzvot? One. And text 2 is if you make a mistake with? All of them. So text 2 only applies if you violate all 613 at the same time? What kind of sin is that? What does that look like? How do you pull that off? That's like the unicycle with the juggling, with the tightrope, on top of the hot air balloon.
It takes a community
Idolatry.
So simple, straight up. If the entire community does any sin, any average sin that's severe enough, whatever, so then they bring how many offerings? One, text 1, right, from Leviticus. They bring one offering, and what is it? A bull for sin offering. If the entire community commits idolatry somehow, not sure how that would happen, but if it happens, if somehow the leaders kind of lead the people erroneously by accident into a situation where they're all worshiping a false deity, we have to come up with a scenario how that would happen, but let's say that happens. So the entire community then would be guilty of that sin that is equivalent to violating all of the mitzvot simultaneously, although it's just one, but it's equivalent, that's how it's explained, text 2. What's then the prescription for atonement? What do they bring? A bull for the fire offering, the burnt offering, and the he-goat for the sin offering. That's what Maimonides explains in text number 3. I just wanted to say it outside, 3a. Because it's a little bit, even in that long text, first of all, it's long, and second of all, it might be a little bit confusing, but that's exactly what he says. Now, here we go. Text number 3. Oh, wait. One more thing. Before we get to text 3b, I'm going to say it outside, and then we'll read it inside. So he says more, there's another wrinkle that we must explain. And that is, how many bulls, or bulls and he-goats, are brought? How many? Based on what you would think is a simple reading of the text. In the first case, where one mitzvah was violated, how many bulls are brought? You would think one. And in the second case where the entire nation serve idols, how many animals are brought? Two animals. But how many of each?
One.
You would think one. The rabbis learn out from a careful reading of the text that it's not one, it's 12. One per tribe. Each tribe, since it's on behalf of the community brings the atonement, the community which is comprised of 12 tribes, therefore each tribe offers up on their behalf either one bull or a bull and a he-goat, and that gets it done. Maimonides text 3b. Mike, I think we're up to you. 3b.
It emerges that if the high court rules erroneously with regard to the worship of false deities, the entire congregation shall bring 12 bulls as burnt offerings and 12 goats as sin offerings. If they ruled erroneously with regard to other mitzvot, they bring 12 bulls as sin offerings.
Make sense? So again, it's the difference between, there's two differences or whatever. Depending on what the sin was, if it's the more egregious sin of idolatry, then you have both the bull and the he-goat. But 12 of each, one per tribe. If you have run-of-the-mill sin, then it's just the 12 bulls, one per tribe. Makes sense? Here's the difference. What if one of the tribes say, we don't want to contribute? You with me? What if one of the tribes, doesn't matter why, what if they say, we're not contributing? They're like, you're not contributing? They're like, no bull. No, we're not giving any bull or goat. Not happening. Now you have 11. What's my question?
Can you atone your sin?
Who? What's my question?
For
the others, right? So let's say one tribe says, yeah, we're out. We're not going to do it. We're the Texas of this whole thing, right? Texas always wants to break away or something. And they fry things. Two things. They deep fry things and they want to break away, right? Okay, so now, I love Texas. My brother-in-law lives in Texas. Texas is the best. That's a disclaimer. We love Texas, but we're just talking about Texas tonight. It's a thing. All right. Mandy, if you're listening, we love you, man. So, Texas, here's the deal. So let's say one tribe doesn't want to bring the offering. So what's the question? Is the offering brought on behalf of the other 11 tribes, is it valid or not? Is it all or nothing, or is it whoever gives? What do you think?
Seems like it would have to be all.
Depends on which sin. Depends on which case. Remember, we have two different scenarios, right? We have either idolatry or another sin. If it's idolatry, what do you think?
All.
If it's another sin, then it's a la carte. Whoever wants to participate is in, and they get atoned. How do I know this? Text number 4. Amy. The verse that you highlighted about the priest, the Sifri does not address the priest part of it, but he addresses the fact that it says the priest shall atone for the entire congregation. The fact that it says entire means that they all have to contribute. If one tribe abstains and you only have 11 bulls and goats, no one gets atoned. Whereas in the first case, it doesn't talk about the entire congregation. It only talks about the entire congregation in the sin, but not in the repair. Look at text number 1. You can look back at it if you like. It talks about if the entire community of Israel sins, but in the fix part of it, in the atonement, it just says the congregation shall bring a young bull. It doesn't say the entire congregation. Whereas in the second case, text 2, from the book of Numbers, it talks about the entire congregation. By the way, again, just as an aside, you see here how a passage in Torah that one casually might say, oh, it's the same law written twice in two different books, and there are some weird nuances that don't match up. There must be something wrong with this. Traditional Jewish thought says two different cases, and there's a lot of intricacy in the law, and there's a lot of depth here. When we talk about idolatry, it's much more grave. There's an extra animal that's brought, and it's all or nothing. Either all the tribes are atoned or no tribes are atoned. Whereas when it comes to another sin, any other sin, so then it's only one animal, per tribe. And if a tribe does not participate, at least the other tribes who are participating, at least their sin is atoned for. Okay, makes sense? What? Who knows?
Because how would the rest of the people feel about that tribe?
Not so tribey. I don't know. I don't know.
It reminds me of jury duty. I was on jury duty. And
yeah. You know, 12 also, right?
So 12 individuals for, you know, society doesn't.
Oh, you see that? That's a great example of the tension between the individual and the community. That's the best example. So one second. This is a great example. When it comes to a jury, if I'm not mistaken, I think I told you my jury duty experience of like a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. Did I tell you? So they call me in for the pregame. You know, I was in the first group. Thank God they got moved into the courtroom, and they start interviewing each person. So, and they pull up your records, your vocational records, and they're like, Mr. Solish, I see that you live in Fulton County, but it looks like there's no job listed by you. I'm like, well, that's because I'm a rabbi and people don't think I do anything. No, I'm kidding. I did say that and they all laughed. It was funny. Whatever. So the point is, when it comes to a jury, there's a lot of pressure to get in certain cases, I think it has to be everyone on the same page, correct? Yes? Many cases? So everyone has to be on the same page. There's a lot of pressure to get everyone on the same page and get out of there and render a verdict. And then you have the tension of the individual between that and the individual who says, but I feel a certain way and I don't want to yield or just relinquish my opinion for the larger group. So here you have a thing. But let's get back to the animals for a second. When it comes to the animals, when it comes to the different sins, so what we see here is this duality between individualism and communalism. And here's, let me flesh it out. When it comes to the sin of idolatry, is it community or individual? Community. It's got to be the community. If you don't have the community, then you have nothing. It's either all or nothing. So it's everyone has to be together for this to work. So it's all about the pressure of the community being together. Whereas when it comes to other sins, what do you see? You can be an individual. You can opt in, you can opt out. Now, if you opt out, what does that mean? I don't know, but you opted out, so you opted out. It is what it is. But you can allow for that individual expression, and it doesn't affect the others. Make sense? So here you have this difference between what type of sin was committed, the communal sin, and the atonement, which reflects this distinction between community and individual. This is one example. Let's see more examples in Jewish thought in a very wide range of Torah ideas and narratives where we see this duality, this tension between the community and the individual. With me on this? Make sense? Process? Okay, let's jump to section number 2. And the text that we're going to cover is, text number 5. Oh, this is fantastic. 5a. Wait, Amy, did you just read?
Yeah.
You read. Okay, Karen.
And Moses wrote all the words of God, and he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 monuments for the 12 tribes of Israel.
Okay, this is day 5 of preparation before Matan Torah, before the giving of the Torah. The Torah was given on the 6th or 7th of Sivan. So in the 5th day of preparation, it says Moses wrote all of these words of God that he was instructing them about how to prepare. And then he woke up early in the morning, built an altar and 12 monuments. Comes along the Mechilta 5b, and now we have a disagreement about about what exactly the monuments look like. Continue please, 5b. Karen? Interesting, right? So, because the Torah says, "Ushteim esrei matzeva," and 12 monuments, "L'shneim asar shifti Yisrael," for the 12 tribes. What does that mean? 12 monuments per each of the 12 tribes, or 12 monuments for all of the 12 tribes, which means one monument per tribe. Does that make sense? You see how there are two ways to understand the verse? I'm going to get my five kids. I don't have five kids. I'm going to get my... So weird. I'm going to get my six kids. So like 2 years ago. Sorry, Reva. All right. Or any of them. So weird that I would single her out. Anyway, so I'm going to get my six kids. Six... letters in the Torah. You could buy a letter for a Torah. Okay. It's not, by the way, this is a great custom. It's a great mitzvah to buy your child a letter in the Torah or yourself. But for kids, they have, I think it's called kidstorah.com or something, or kidssafertorah.com. It's $1. And you get a name in a Torah. It's the best deal in town. Or in any town. It's amazing. Anyway, so let's say I say something. You know, I bought for my six children six letters in the Torah. What does that mean? One letter per or six letters per? It's vague, right? From the wording, you could understand it both ways. So here it says that Moses built for the 12 tribes 12 monuments. 12 monuments per tribe or one monument per tribe? Let's say a monument is a big stone, let's just say. So is it one stone per tribe or 12 stones per tribe? Obviously the rabbis disagreed about this. Because why not? They left no stone unturned. Yeah, there you go. So it was all about, you know, and how did he do this? He was rolling stones.
So my question is, yeah. What's the 144th mitzvah? And then that
right, 12 times 12, right. It's a mystery here. So we can look it up somewhere. Here's the deal. What does this dispute reflect? The same duality between community and individual. Think about it. If Torah says he put up 12 monuments, if you say that the total number was 12, one per tribe, what does that reflect? Community or individualism? Community. Because it says he erected 12 monuments. And if you understand it, that the 12 monuments are one per tribe, that means the 12 are collectively for everybody, that means everyone is grouped together in the 12. If you say that it means that he gave each one 12, what does that reflect? Individualism of each tribe gets a set of 12. But you don't have the collective, how the tribes get together. Does this make sense? You see kind of how that's reflected? Again, the Torah says he built one altar and 12 monuments for the tribes. If you say that it's one monument per tribe. So when it says he made 12 monuments, it means for all of the tribes together collectively he gave them 12. One per. That's a collective message or collective action. Whereas if we say that when the Torah says that he built 12 monuments, one per tribe, well then that's each tribe gets their own set of monuments. Their own playground of monuments. Whatever they're doing with, right? So that means more individualism per tribe and not this collective nationhood. Again, this duality, the tension, if you will, between community and individual, in this case, individual tribe. Let's take a look at another instance of this, which is reflected in the garments of the priests, which we read about last week as well as a few weeks ago. Last week it was done. They made the garments. We read about last week that the garments were made. A few weeks ago, the instruction of how they ought to be made. Either way, there were two places on the high priest where the names of the Jewish people were written, were inscribed in the stones. What were the two places?
You mean on their garments? The breastplate?
Yes, on the breastplate. Now, what was the breastplate? It was like a square, and it had 12 stones. On each stone was written what?
One tribe.
And then there were other stones in which it was written on the shoulder straps of the ephod of the apron. There were shoulder straps, and on the shoulder straps it was adorned with one jewel on one strap and one on the other. You know what? There's a picture in here. A few weeks ago they had a picture. Let's just look up the Chumash. Super simple. I'll show you what it looks like, or an artist's rendition. 537. Please turn to 537, and there you have the apron. You see that, the little inset on 537?
Yeah.
The apron looks like an apron, and then you have the shoulder straps, and there at the edge, you see that? The edge of the shoulder straps, you have the Shoham stone. One on one side, one on the other side. And on those two stones were engraved also the 12 tribes. How do you think that worked? Six and six. And the Torah says six on one, six on the other. Turn the page to 539 in the Chumash. And now you have the breastplate and you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 12 stones, one name per stone. What does this duality reflect? Or yet two instances of the 12 tribes being listed. In one of them, what do you find? In the shoulder straps, what do you find?
You find the six and six, which would be more, I guess, individual.
Well, and it's more communal. Because they're being joined together. And there's still two different stones, but at least you have more tribes being grouped together as a whole unit. In others, you have distinct tribes, but they're being grouped together as a communal unit. Whereas on the breastplate, you have each tribe isolated. Each one is an individual, even though it's all part of one garment. But the stones themselves, each stone is a different color. Each was a different type of stone. So every stone was unique. Every tribe was unique. So this is individualism. The breastplate, 12 stones, 12 names, 12 colors, 12, right? Whereas the shoulder straps, there were six grouped together in each stone. So that's community. You take the individuals, you throw them together. Mazel tov. Here's your neighbor.
But before, one stone represented the community. You know, when you were building the monument, the one stone, it was community. And now the one stone. So, I mean, it really is the context.
Yeah, it's the context. It's the context. Exactly. So what's the point? The point is that when it comes to offerings, sacrifices for communal sin, when it comes to the stone monuments that Moses set up for the tribes before the giving of the Torah at Sinai, when it comes to the names of the tribes as they were inscribed or engraved, etched into the stones that the high priest would wear when he did the service, when it comes to all these cases, we find this tension, this duality between grouping people together as one and allowing for their individuality. Do all the tribes have to bring the atonement, or is it tribe by tribe? Are they all part of 12 stones, or do each have their own 12 stones? It's kind of like, you know what it's like? I don't have a good example right now, but I'm going to think of one. For the stone, Karen, to address your question about the stone monuments in 1 and 12 and that thing, it's like, imagine if you needed 12 keys to open up a certain palace. There were 12 doors, 12 locks, etc. And you say, I'm going to give each one of you one key. So how many people do you need to open up the door? 12. So I give each tribe a key to open up the door, but it takes 12 keys. So you're forcing achdus, you're forcing the unity amongst the group. You with me? Whereas if you give each tribe all 12 keys, so each tribe, they don't need each other. Each tribe is an individual. I have my 12 keys, I can get in. That's the difference. Whereas there you have that duality as well by the stone monuments, and then of course, by the stones and the high priest, you have the same duality. Are the names separated out individually, or are they combined together on one common stone or two common stones, but there's a collective element to it? This is stated in the Torah Studies book on page 6a, sorry, on page 218 and 219 with text 6a and text 6b. And again, this is the duality of the engraving of the stones. We did that outside. We're not going to do it inside. We saw the pictures. We don't need to read the book. Now, I mean, we watched the movie. We saw, right? We don't got the cliff notes. So now, the same duality exists in Torah. The same duality exists in Torah. Let's take a look at text number 8. Text number 8, Sandrine. So the halacha says, Jewish law says that a Torah scroll has to have all, well, we say that they have 600,000 letters, although it's more like 250,000, whatever. A Torah scroll has to have all the letters. Every letter. If there's one letter, even a small yud, tiny little yud missing, The Torah scroll is entirely pasul, it's disqualified. You're not allowed to read from it. We have a Torah scroll in here, one with the white cover, and it has the belt on the outside of the cover indicating that it's not kosher. Why is it not kosher? Because there are a few letters that are not written properly. And even one letter that's not written properly, it's not kosher. Which means you have to have all 600,000 letters together, community, right? Can't have a community, a Torah community, without all the letters representing. So that's community. What about individuality? You also have that as well with Jewish law. Continue, David, please, text 9.
Every letter in the Torah scroll must be surrounded by parchment on all four sides. No two letters may touch. Rather, between every letter there should be a sliver of space, equivalent to the space of one small letter. They should not be too close together so that it appears as if they are one letter. If this is altered and two letters are so close together they appear to be co-joined, the scroll is invalid.
You would think, if the goal is community and everyone getting together, so letters should be all on top of each other. It should be a letter party. Right? What's wrong with that? Let the letters commingle. Let them have an agila. What's going on? Let them dance the hora. Oh, we had so much fun in Manhattan with the teens. Oh, I'm so embarrassed to say this. Our running gag was every time we saw one of those perfume shops or whatever it is, the makeup shop, we would sing, Sephora, da-da, Sephora, Sephora. You with me? All right. It's a thing. It was a thing. Anywho, so you would think, if it's all about all the letters together, so let them touch. Let them fabring. It's like, what brings out a greater unity? Script or block lettering? Script. I'm answering the question. Sorry, I know I asked it. Right? Script, we're afloat. Right? It's cursive? What do you call it? Cursive? Sorry, my bad.
They don't teach that in school anymore, which is...
Is it called script or did I just make that up? Is cursive script? Is cursive script? It is, right? Dodge that bullet. It's been a while. It's been a long time. They don't teach cursive?
Jewish day school, where Jewish day schools I've been at, they do. But many of the public schools don't, which is interesting because, again, this shift societally to individuality.
Oh, it's reflected in the script.
It's reflected in the fact that they're teaching, they just teach block lettering in schools now.
It started with the block lettering. Started with block lettering. Well, who needs a signature? We have avatars.
Yeah.
So old school.
Kids type.
Right, kids type. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. We have yet to see what all this stuff is going to do. All right, we'll be fine. The kids will be okay. Here's the deal. The kids will be all right. Isn't that a line, right? By the way, the kids were great today.
Yeah.
They walked out. It's the whole thing.
Everywhere.
Everywhere they walked out. Oh, the public school kids. Oh, it's fantastic. AJA, they walked out. Yeah, Jewish schools walked out. Oh, it's fantastic. They have, listen, it's going to be the kids. Listen, Jewish, we're not going to get political. Whatever, we'll bring it back. Let's bring it back. Okay, so let's get back to Torah scrolls. So Torah scroll, you need all 600,000 letters. Without any letter, it's no good. So collect, letters come together. No, we can't have any straggler letters. It's like, oh, I didn't get a chance to jump in the scroll. What do you mean? Get on the scroll. We can't. There's no Torah without you. Everyone get on board. Collective, but it can't be too collective. It can't be too fabrengi. Every letter has to be distinct. Every letter has to have its own individuality. So here you have within the laws of a kosher Torah scroll, collective, but individual, with space, tension, and now we have. Perhaps the starkest example of this. Only because it's such a dramatic story and it's been told so many times in so many different ways. But here's a new one to try on. Moses comes down the mountain with the first set of tablets. The people are worshiping the sin of the golden calf. Or they're sinning with the golden calf by worshiping it. What does he do with the tablets? He breaks them. A few months go by. He gets atonement for the people. Most of the people. He comes down with a second set of tablets. What happens with those? Still have them. They're still whole. Here's the question. What? No one ever sinned since? No one ever sinned? No one ever... what's going on here? No one ever committed any negative action? Even communally, we didn't commit... There was a lot of idolatry in the times of the first temple. Idolatry was rampant. Read the story. You're in the Monday night. It's idolatry left and right.
Everywhere.
everywhere. Every idols for you. Yeah, right? Everyone's serving idols. Right? So how come they didn't break the tablets?
Well, they were already part of the contract.
Saying the first time or the second time?
The second time.
That repent, that tshuva should be built in. That they should not break them.
Well, he broke the first one, so that they were never part of the contract.
Right.
But the second one, they had already agreed to it.
They had already agreed to it. Right, so you're saying it's too late, they have to... Okay, but there's another dual, there's another, it, along the lines of the community and individual, it brings out the same idea. What's the idea? The first tablets, they needed to keep all of the mitzvot. And the moment they broke one, you got to break the whole thing. You with me? They sinned one, they did one sin, got to break the whole thing. Because it's all or nothing. That's the community, right? Everyone's got to be on the same page. If anyone goes out, we don't have a community. The whole thing is broken. Communal. Second tablets reflect individuality. Even if there's one sin, okay, we got another 612. We don't have to break the whole thing. All right, that one needs repair. It's fine. We're working on other ones. You see how that... you're right what you're saying, but this is a new way of looking at it as well. The first tablets represent community. On a communal level, everything needs to be the same. Has to be, how do you pronounce it? Homogeneous? Is that how you say it? Yeah. Everything's got to be the same. So if there's something that's broken, the whole thing is broken. The whole thing is messed up. Whereas the second set of tablets, it's more of the individual, mitzvah by mitzvah. So if one of the mitzvot are broken, you don't have to break all the tablets. You don't break the tablets.
Our community, though, which I, you know, even in our Monday night class,
there's always a goody two shoes.
Got to be somebody.
Yeah.
Was, you know,
always somebody railing against the others.
Yeah. Like, either a prophet or a judge or
one, like one video, and that's it.
Right.
No one else.
It's like, hey, what are y'all doing? Oh, that's the guy. All right. So all of this should hopefully bring out that we have this incredible duality between the community and the individual.
You know, when they did all that idolatry, what was it? When they were in the desert and that, you know, people lured them into idolatry.
Yes, Midian.
Yeah. So that was idolatry, but it's still.
They didn't break the tablets. Right, right. And they didn't break the tablets. The point is that the first tablets, it was a stage where it was all or nothing. The second set of tablets, okay, so we'll work on this, we'll work on fixing this, or whatever, but you don't have to break everything. It's not like so dramatic.
Changed, in other words.
Something shifted.
But like, the first set wasn't necessarily broken, and like, the fact that, like on Yom Kippur, that you're atoning for everyone's sins.
Yes.
So
there's a collective there.
Yeah.
Yom Kippur represents a collective in a sense because we say Hashem knew, Bagad knew, we sinned, we acted. So many interesting words in the Hashem knew, the translation. I don't know. Perfidiously or something. Perfidiously. What is that? But I did it. I don't know what it is. Or we did it. I don't know. So where is that? Yes. Oh, so let's speak about that. Text 12. Did you just read? You just read. I'll read text 12. 224. Uri of Strelitz, one of Hasidic rabbi, writes the following. The Jewish people are likened to letters of the Torah scroll. Just as the Torah scroll is disqualified if it is missing one letter, so too the Shekhinah, the divine presence, does not rest with the Jewish people if even one person is missing. If so, the law that each letter must remain apart and not touch its neighbor is quite puzzling. Is unity not a great ideal that there be no division between us at all? In other words, if we all need to be together, so why does there need to be space from a Jewish personhood perspective. So he says, listen to this. Rather, this law alludes to the idea that though it is important for all of Israel to be one, nevertheless, it is not good for this unity to be constant and unrelenting. For each Jew must have some time in the day to be alone with God. How powerful. There's power to communal prayer, going to Shul and Davening. There's power to communal Torah study, which is what we're doing right now. There's power to community and unity in general. But the Rebbe, Uri of Strelitzk, writes in his Imre Kodesh, in text 12, which we just read, that a Jew needs to have some time in the day to be alone with God as an individual. You have to nurture both. You have to nurture the community, but you also have to nurture the individual. You can't have one and not the other. It doesn't allow for a healthy scenario. You need that balance, and which may have some tension. Now, text 13a, 13b, 14a, and 14b are all from the great Rogachev Ragon. He was Rabbi Yosef Rosen, he of Rogachev. He was lived the last century, an absolute genius of Torah study. He was the fellow I've mentioned him before, who did not cut his hair. He was a Nazir, he didn't cut his hair. And it said that his hair was painful. It would hurt if he cut it. It says in the Zohar that, it says in Kabbalah that hair represents the brain. It's kind of like, I don't know, represents, but it's like somehow connected with the brain. So I guess his brain was so powerful that even in the hair he could feel there was a sensitivity there. It also says about him, the Rebbe said about him, that his pain, and I mentioned this also before and many times in different classes in various contexts, that his pain was that on Shabbat when he had a brilliant insight in Talmud, he couldn't write it down. And that's what bothered him. And he knew that after Shabbat he would forget it because his mind worked so fast. If he didn't write it down, this flash of insight would be gone. And so that was his challenge in Shabbat. You know, challenge for keeping Shabbat. Everyone has a challenge for keeping Shabbat and other things. His challenge was, not that he was necessarily contemplating not, but his challenge was not being able to write things down, which would, you know, be painful because he would, this idea perhaps would be lost forever. Either way, the Rogachever explains all of these ideas. Lolly, will you read this, text 13a?
The argument whether Moses made each of the 12 altars from 12 stones or of one stone reflects two ways of understanding the composition of the nation. Are they a conglomerate or are they made up of many detailed parts?
In other words, are they one unit and therefore it's you need all 12 together, or are they many detailed parts and then each one can have their own set? Text 13b, please continue.
Jewish people fused into one being. As is explained in the Mechilta's reading of the verse, an Israel camp. The singular form is used to signal that the nation was as with one heart. But after the shattering of the tablets, each tribe was left distinct from the others. Therefore, the ephod stones had the tribes mixed together over two stones. Conversely, on the breastplate, each tribe had its own stone.
So he says now 2 points over here. Number one, the first tablets represented unity, and therefore, if something broke, everything broke. That's where the tablets were shattered. Whereas the second tablets, each tribe was distinct. So therefore, again, you could have some tribes sinning with the Midianite or whatever, some people sinning, but it doesn't break the whole collective because it's individual. And he says, therefore, also the ephod stones, the two stones on the shoulders, they had the tribes mixed together, unity, and the breastplate was each tribe separately. So again, we have this duality. And of course, if we go back to the sacrifices, text 14a, Debbie, please read this. Let me just make sure that it makes sense to read it inside. Yeah, why not? Text 14a, please read.
Within God, there is no differentiation or variety.
Therefore, there is a major difference in law when it comes to the inadvertent transgression of idolatry. When it comes to other sins, if the high court ruled erroneously and a majority of the people followed the ruling, each tribe is forgiven when it brings its sacrifice. But when it comes to the sin of idol worship, it is taught that forgiveness is only granted when every tribe brings its offering.
In other words, they all have to bring its all or nothing. And please conclude with text 14b. One more, Debbie.
Being, because the prohibition against idolatry was set by God to us all, were we all as one when God spoke, therefore, before that prohibition, we are considered as one being.
So, he says, the Rogatchev concludes this idea by saying that since the mitzvah, or the prohibition against idolatry, was said by God standing at Sinai. When we stood at Sinai, God said it to all of us as one, and it came from God, who is the ultimate of oneness and not distinct individual parts. God is the ultimate one, and he said it to us as a nation of oneness. So therefore, when the entire community commits the sin of idolatry, so then every tribe has to be on board. But when it's another sin, each tribe on their own. So here we have, again, the conclusion of this idea. We've seen it through many different parts, how you have this idea of community and individuality. And here we also have the idea of community, or collect some sort of this unity within Torah itself. You have different areas of Torah, stories, mitzvot, laws, and yet they all reflect a similar theme, which is this duality. So, today is 26 years to the day that the Rebbe had a stroke, 27th day of Adar. And this stroke, I don't know if we can use these terms, but I will, robbed the Rebbe of his ability to speak. Until a few years later, and he passed away in 1994. So this was 1992, 27th day of Adar. And the Shabbat before, this happened on a Monday afternoon. The Shabbat before, he spoke about the Torah portions of Vayakel and Pekudei, which were last week's Torah portions. And he said, Vayakel means, the meaning of the two words are very different. Vayakel means gather, and Pekudei means count. So one is, and you oftentimes find the double portions that we combine together due to the calendar. We have to combine, they're complete opposites in the name. Like Nitzavim Vayelech. Nitzavim means standing, and Vayelech means going. So you have standing and going, and they're together. It's like a weird thing. And this also, last week we read in Shul a few days ago, on Shabbat, Vayakel and Pekudei. Vayakel is they gathered, and Pekudei is this, they counted the, what's the word, when they counted up all the contributions, the audit. They audited all the contributions that were given, but they counted each piece of gold, each piece of silver, so it's individuality. And the Rebbe spoke then, that last Shabbat, a three-hour Fabrengen, I happened to be there. We had a class trip, I think I mentioned the story before. We had a school trip from Pittsburgh. We used to go in like once or twice a year. We were there for that Shabbat. I was there at that Fabrengen. I was 13 years old.
Yeah.
And I was there the Sunday when we got dollars. Everybody would give out dollars every Sunday. I was there the last Sunday. I mean, the day before the Rebbe stroke. The Rebbe spoke about the two concepts of Vayakel and Pekudei, which means, again, community and individuality. And he said, there's something so fascinating. You would think, if you want to create a perfect community, what would you need? If you want to build a watch that works, what do you need? Every part has to be precise. Perfect. If you want to have a perfect unit, you have to have perfect pieces. Right? So the Rebbe says, Vayakel Pekudei. Vayakel is the community, and Pekudei is the individual. So before the question that I just asked, let me rewind. This is toward the end. Let me just go back a half a step. So what it means is a community should never overlook the individual, and the individual should never overlook the community. There has to be, when the portions are joined, it means the community should look out for the person. Should never be so big that it doesn't see individual, and the individual should respect the collective goals of the community. So they should work together. But then the Rebbe said, so why is Vayakel before Pekudei? Why is the community before the individual? You would think you need individuals to make up a community. So start off pekudei, individuals, and then vayakel. I'm saying the double portion, the themes are out of order. It takes people to make a community. So why is a community and then people? Just chronologically, you didn't get your community until you had enough of those people, and then you got a community. So it should be pekudei and then vayakel. In the names, I forget the portions, but the name, the concept. The Rebbe said, because we think, perhaps, that how do you get a community with perfect people? The Rebbe said, that's wrong. That's not how it works. Human beings are not like watches. And communities are not like, we're not watches. We're not watch pieces. We have a soul, and the soul has beautiful potential and perfect potential inside, even if we're not living it and activating it. And so you can have, not only you can have, you do have people, imperfect people, that when they come together, they can make a perfect community. And so the Rebbe advocated in this last Shabbat Fabrengen, the last time he spoke and Fabrengen, he spoke about the drive to build communities. Build communities. And that will already uplift the individual. If you wait till you perfect yourself before you build a community, never going to get there. But come together as a community and you'll see the magic happen. Vayakel and then pekudei. So there's a tension. There's always a tension between the community and the individual. The Rebbe looked at this and said, enough with the philosophy. Do we care about the community? Do we care about the individual? Enough with the philosophy. Go out there and build communities. He sent shluchim, and he said all of us are shluchim in our own way. Go out there and bring people together. Build communities. And when you build communities, you'll see the beauty come out. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.